Mr. Paul Brunton, while reading Upadesh Manjari, came across the statement that the ego, the world, and God are all unreal. He desired to use a different word for God, or at least a qualifying subjective, that is, the creative force or personal God. Sri Bhagavan explained that God means samasti, that is, all that is, plus the being. In the same way as I means the individual plus the being. And the world means the variety plus being. The being is in all cases real. The all, the variety, and the individual is in each case unreal. So also the union of the real and the unreal, the mixing up or the false identification is wrong. It amounts to saying sat, asat, vilakshana, that is, transcending the real and the unreal, sat and asat. Reality is that which transcends all concepts, including that of God. Inasmuch as the name of God is used, it cannot be true. The Hebrew word Jehovah, which equals I am, expresses God correctly. You know, the Jews, they don't even say the word God. I mean, Orthodox.
Yeah.
You know, just put dot there.
Okay.
You haven't you seen that somewhere?
Yeah.
But the others use the word Jehovah. Jehovah Witnesses. I am witness.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty good. You know, you heard of the Jehovah Witnesses?
Yes. They're very
popular. They go around from house to house. They're evangelical.
Mm-hmm. I think Jehovah, I read it broken up. Jehovah means I am that, and Jehovah means I am, and Jah means I.
The Hebrew word Jehovah equals I am expresses God correctly. Absolute being is beyond expression. The word cannot be replaced, nor need it be replaced. In the Ashram Bulletin they have about Skanda Ashram, 1966. Skanda Ashram, up on the sacred hill of Arunachala, where Sri Bhagavan lived for 7 years, between leaving Virupakshi Cave, just below it, and taking up his abode at the site of the present ashram, is a great attraction for visitors to the ashram, especially to those from the west, who like it not only for the vibration of his presence felt there, but also for the solitude and the pleasant shade afforded by the huge mango tree just behind it, and for the fine clear water of the spring. There's a big jackfruit tree there. Have you seen that? Next to where mother's some up. No, died right over there. I've seen big jackfruits like that on it.
No.
So a lot of Westerners go there. Have you been there?
Mm-hmm.
You see a lot of Westerners, right?
Yeah. I like it there too.
They walk and meditate there.
It's like paradise.
Water in the spring, the spring water flowing perennially just beside it, which doesn't happen anymore. You know, it dries up now.
Up to the,
even up to the 90s, it was flowing perennially.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I took part of the acid there. Yes. Although you're not supposed to take acid up on the hill. But he always considered, he always called it Ganga Jal.
Uh-huh.
He used to drink it. Ganga. Because Bhagavan, you know, put, he showed the spot and digged it. And the water started coming. So like Shiva had the water, Ganga coming.
Uh-huh.
You know, you see Shiva
with
the water
Ganga coming.
Yeah. So Bhagavan always called it Ganga Jal. So I thought instead of going to Varanasi to put his ashes. I didn't show anybody because you're not supposed to bring ashes up on the hill. And,
yeah.
Like that's in there, nice. Flowing down. It was built out from a cave into its present form by the late Sri Kandaswami Gaundar, an ardent devotee of Sri Maharshi, who leveled the ground with his own hands and built the basement whereon the superstructure was raised by the efforts of the late Perumal Swami. You know, for planting those trees up there, he dug big pits, like 6 feet deep, 8 feet wide, and they can put dirt in there, brought carrying dirt. And after Sri Bhagavan came down to Sri Raman Ashramam, not much attention was paid to Skanda Ashram until 1940, when the grandson of the late Kandaswami Gaundar carried out the necessary repairs. Sri Sayadas, a resident of the ashram, he's the one who hand-colored those photos which we have in Nova Scotia ashram, in the altar. Before they didn't have, you know, computer digitization, you know, so they would have black and white and they would hand-color them with oils and cotton. So he's the one who hand-colored them. They gave them to us in 73, those photos in Nova Scotia, on the altar. The Sayadas. Sri Sayadas, a resident of the ashram, recently took up the task of renovating the ashram and completely whitewashed it and repainted the woodwork. We are sure that the renovation will be appreciated by visitors. The traditional purification ceremony, Punya Vachanam, was performed on the 4th June when several devotees participated in the function. I don't know, I told you about that woman, that girl that Bhagavan gave the mantra, Om Namo Bhagavate, her picture's here. You can see the group. You see her, she's on the bottom row there, smiling, and the...
Oh, yeah.
That's her, Kamakshi, right there. And that's the president's wife there. You can see, she's very cheerful and everything. She's very lively, this lady right here.
Yeah.
They used to have a picture in the dining hall. But I think the family took it anymore. They write a little bit. A devoted family, Sri Monagala Venkataramaya, who later became Sri Swami Ramanananda Saraswati, and the author of Talks with Sri Ramana Maharshi, the translator of Kaivalya Navanita, Tripura Rahasya, etc. Most of them published by the ashram. You never see it in there, but now they put it. You know, during Bhagavan's time, they translated something of Bhagavan or Bhagavan liked.
They didn't put their name.
They never put their name there, you know. Now they put it there after he's gone. Was a long-standing devotee of Sri Maharshi from the very early days of the end of the last century. All his relations and descendants have carried on his devotion to Sri Maharshi, and this has now become the tradition in their family. The sacred ceremony of his sons was celebrated at the ashram during the lifetime of the Maharshi. Now the grandson, he was a widower also, and he moved in the ashram. And now the grandsons, in their turn, have had their sacred thread ceremony in the ashram before the samadhi of Sri Maharshi in the traditional orthodox style on Wednesday, 25th May, 1966. Four young boys of the third generation in that line had the initiation into Brahmajnana that day, and we wish these young brahmacharis all the best in the quest of the infinite, as also all material prosperity. Well, good luck, and you know. I would think the first one's enough. You know. We invoke Sri Maharshi's blessing on them. And then they say the ceremony of the sacred thread in progress. Ladies go gay at such function.
Gay.
This is the Kamakshi, the cottage there. Sri Kamakshi's new house. Speak of Arunachala. See, blessing the house. See, here the occasion was also then taken for the daughter and son-in-law of Swami Ramananda Saraswati to perform the Griha Pravesham of their house in Sri Ramananagar, very near the ashram, in the grounds of which the body of the late Swami, Swami Ramananda Saraswati, is the samadhi there. It's right next to Arthur Alcorn's house. Mm. Very near the ashram, with the body of the late Swami is interred. When not occupied by them, it is in the ashram custody, and we accommodate guests there. We wish Dr. O. Ramachandraya. So he stayed there many years because his wife died at Kamakshi. And Srimati Kamakshi Ramachandraya, all happiness, and may be given them to reside near the ashram after retirement from active service. Something in Janiki Amma, obituary. 1966 she died.
Mm.
She's very popular. It's like I heard there's like 1,000 families living around in Tanjore, right?
Yeah.
She had.
Yeah.
You know, Aparna's parent, father.
Yeah, her father and her Como, and his father's sister.
Como's mother.
Yeah,
was a big
Coma. And then that tennis Krishnan's this thing, and Sudha, Toronto.
Sudha, yeah. Oh, Janaki, yeah.
Sudha. Yeah. Yeah. Mostly, you know, the people who are like widowed or orphans. Aparna's parents, I think, were father
was
an orphan.
Orphan,
yeah.
Nagaswami Iyer, the elder brother of Bhagavan, Sri Ramana Maharshi, passed away toward the end of the last century, sometime after Maharshi left home for Tiruvannamalai. His widow, oh, this is another Janaki Amma.
Not Janaki Amma.
No, the widow of Bhagavan's older brother.
Oh.
You know, she lived quite a while. Look at 1966.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She probably was very young.
Maybe.
When she married, you know.
Child marriages in those days.
Janaki Amma lived thereafter with her parents for nearly a quarter of a century. She came to Sri Bhagavan in 1939 on the occasion of his Shastya Purti.
60th birthday.
She came to Bhagavan on the 60th birthday. On that occasion, clad in the usual loincloth, Bhagavan jocularly remarked that he was very shy of appearing before his sister-in-law in the loincloth. And which he used to do household chores at Madurai and Tiruchuli, and that as if in punishment for the same, the self-same sister-in-law had made him only a loincloth wearer and come to see him in that dress. From that time onward, Janaki Amma had been living with her nephew, the present president of the ashram. She breathed her last on Wednesday, 18th of May. I think she wanted him to help, she wanted Bhagavan to help her with something, you know, making some prasad or something. And he had to put on a loincloth to do it, and he wouldn't do it because he didn't want to put it, he felt shy putting a loincloth. He said he has to wear one all the time.
See, when the children had the sacred ceremony, like Rishabha had it when he was 9 at that time, yeah, that's what they do to the kids. They wear the loincloth and their hair is shaved, only a little bit of hair is left. And they look very cute, you know.
This is the obituary of Shankara Amal. Widowed comparatively early in life and left with 3 children, Shankara Amal came to see Bhagavan in 1936. Having heard of him from the disciples of Sri Kulandai Swamigal of Madurai and Avadhut Purusha, whom she was serving in Madurai, she came and settled down in the ashram in the year 1939 and left it very rarely to see her sons. She had been serving in the kitchen of the ashram since then. She had learnt the works of Sri Maharshi and Tamal thoroughly and imparted them also to the children of the present president of the ashram and to other devotees, Sundaram and Mani and Ganesh. Only once had she occasion to speak to Sri Maharshi, but that one occasion is worth recording. Once Bhagavan was repeating a verse in Tamil from Kaivalya Navanita to the effect, "Praise be to the Guru who, for countless generations, has been within me and guiding me, and now has taken shape to initiate and grant me salvation." Thereupon Bhagavan left for the Goshala in accordance with his custom. Overhearing this verse from Bhagavan's lips, the next day Shankar Amal approached Sri Bhagavan for the first and last time in her life. She lived there all these, you know, she couldn't, most of them they couldn't get the courage even to come and talk. And when there's so much awe, you know.
Yeah.
But that didn't mean anything, they still got everything. For the first lesson, and requested for upadesh, in reply to which Bhagavan quoted another verse from the same book, the gist of it, which is, "O son, who have been wandering about like dust in a whirlwind, having forgotten your own self, know yourself, and that is your support, and then you are free of all troubles. You asked, and so I give this upadesh." Bhagavan then went back to the old hall. Shankar Amal thereafter had no more doubts and nothing to ask. For nearly 27 years, Shankar Amal served Sri Maharshi in the ashram faithfully with little or no interval. She was ill for just a few days before she passed away at the age of 80 on Wednesday, 18th May, at 7:30 a.m. A few hours before the sister-in-law of Bhagavan, her cremation was largely attended by the devotees of the ashram and the neighborhood. May her soul rest in peace at the lotus feet of Sri Maharshi. So they wouldn't do the cremation together, like they're both. I mean, Bhagavan's sister-in-law, older brother's wife, died. So they must have just stayed there and did one cremation after another. Introducing T.P.R., T.P. Ramachandraya. I had met him, really recorded him. And the audio team. Sri T.P. Ramachandra Iyer, whose native home is Tiruvannamalai itself, has been an earnest devotee of Sri Bhagavan from very early times.
Isn't he the gentleman who's sitting down there?
What's that?
I think so.
He cut off.
He's the only like married person that was attending on Bhagavan. He was a lawyer by profession. You can see him in the archival films also walking with Bhagavan around the same time.
Yeah, he's the one that's sitting.
He hails from an ancient Orthodox Brahmin family, just to prove that this is a Brahmana ashrama. With all these Brahmins getting their sacred threads and all these things going on. Who for generations were well known in Tiruvannamalai for their traditional learning, discipline, and piety. Endearingly known and called merely as TPR by Sri Bhagavan and others, he has lived as one of Sri Bhagavan's family here for decades. Unobtrusive by nature and silent in disposition, he has been an austere life of service and surrender at the lotus feet of Sri Bhagavan, in whom he found his refuge and guide, which was the haven of his desire. This he attributes to his Purva Samskaras and spiritual tradition of his ancestors. That means his good samskaras, past good actions.
That we are listening in the morning, this, that itself is good samskara.
Sri Bhagavan had narrated an incident in 1896, the year of his arrival in Tiruvannamalai, when he was staying in the precincts of the Arunachala temple. TPR's grandfather, an elderly and pious person, used to visit him daily. One day, out of affection and regard, conducted him to his house and gave a ceremonial meal in the householder's manner. This was the only house which Sri Bhagavan entered to take bhiksha.
Wow.
In the usual way, after he had left his Madurai home. This information was given in full detail by Sri Maharshi himself. Now, he said he conducted him to his house.
And Bhagavan said, Bhagavan went.
No, no, what he had come, they picked him up.
And
said, come on. And Bhagavan didn't respond. And there was two other guys that lift him. So they lifted him, and they and he, had no choice,
That they give bhiksha to yogis and sannyasis is considered really good. Because in those days they just lived on that only, the bhiksha.
Apart from the advantages of his traditional and parental discipline, TPR also received an English education, which equipped him for the profession of law. This was far from his natural aptitudes or reflective bent of mind. However, in later years, it proved a blessing in disguise, as from 1933, for over 10 years, some disgruntled persons embarked upon a spate of litigation against the ashram, and TPR unstintingly devoted himself in his time to defending the interest of the ashram as an act of service to successful conclusion. This activity gave him still greater opportunities for close association with Sri Bhagavan. There used to be, and during this time, to be a lawyer was considered like a virtuous occupation, unlike America. They used to call them pocket stuffers. They wear gowns when they have the court case. And the client, they didn't demand like this amount, I'll do this amount. No, they would put money into their pockets, what they could afford.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
From behind, they would just shove money when the case was over or whatever. So it was more like a better profession back in the day. That's why you see many lawyers coming to...
That was a good profession. And some people who are rich, they give lands and everything too. The fees was paid to the lawyer, no matter what.
Yeah, but they wouldn't demand so much.
They'll never demand, especially from poor people. Mm. They won't demand.
So,
some of them were.
Of course, but you see many lawyers coming to Bangalore at that time. You don't see any lawyers coming here.
Yeah. That's true.
That's true.
Yeah, liar is a liar. They lie so much.
In his early days, TPR, Avro felt a burning desire to come upon one who could truly harness his entire being and guide him to greater strength. His learning and ancestral disciplines could not help understand the dilemma of life's activities. The pleasures of ordinary life and activity on the one hand, and fear and misery of death seen all around on the other. He had come into contact with a few persons, such as the Swami of the Ramakrishna Order, Dr. Annie Besant, and later Sri Kavyakanta Ganapati Muni, who voluntarily gave him a mantra for japa, which he never used. Yeah. That's why they say voluntarily. He was offered, and even that, it was not that he asked for.
Theosophical Society in Adair flourished.
Right? Yeah, no thanks. Yeah. 90%. He was ahead of that.
Rukmani Devi Arundel also was a follower.
You know, Shivakani, this Rukmani Devi, she helped her.
Yeah, because she was stranded in Nairobi, right?
Yeah,
she was.
Rukmani the one that was in Untouchable?
No.
No, Rukmani
yeah.
was an
Iyer.
Oh,
okay. She's my grandfather's classmate
yeah.
in college. She was the only girl, all were boys. Yeah. And she used to come in a bicycle.
Which was very unheard of in
those days. Unheard of at that time.
And they're displaying themselves in public. You know.
And she married a German. And she started a dance school. She learned to dance after getting married. And she was very progressive. She almost became president of India. They had voted for her. Yeah, they helped
Ramesh's mother. Ramesh's father was an engineer. He was an engineer in Nairobi, quite young, and he had a heart attack and died. And she was with these two little boys, like 3 and 5 years old.
Ramesh. Ramesh, yeah.
And the mother, then she
came. Ramesh was very little when their father died.
They came back to Madras, and she helped him. And she got a job. You know, she worked her whole life. She used to lock them in their room, in their apartment, because she couldn't have a babysitter, she didn't have no.
She could call me.
She didn't afford a babysitter. You know?
Yeah, she used to lock them in and go to work.
Oh, okay.
And then when she came here, they would lock her in and go to work, the two brothers. No, really, they did that.
But those two boys are very devoted to the mother. Yeah. Really, really are.
And she seems just like a crazy lady now, but she's really powerful, strong woman.
No, she's nice. Yeah. It's okay sometimes.
Mm-hmm. But she doesn't listen to anybody.
I'm something crazy.
She doesn't listen to anybody. You tell her, don't do this, she'll do it and double on it. You know?
See, once you reach it, suddenly you become stubborn. You know, that's there.
Tell me about it.
But she is nice, you know.
Yeah,
when I'm here in this country, she never used to let anybody sing in the Hindu temple. Mm-hmm. She'll keep on one after another.
She used to sing.
She won't give anybody a chance.
You know, she's a disciple of this Rama Devi.
Yeah.
And they used to sing bhajan. They have their bhajan book. And she taught her boys how to sing.
Yeah, they
boys.
Sing. They really literally sing. They, both
especially
Ramesh
the other
Rajesh.
Brother you haven't met, Rajesh. Yeah. He's a very good singer. Rajesh is excellent.
Rajesh is a good singer, yeah.
Rajesh, yeah. He can lead a whole group of singing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The older brother.
So in the temple, you know, I used to take, at the time my son was not born, then my son was not. Sing. She won't let anybody else sing.
Okay, so that this all came from, like he got the mantra from Ganapati Muni, and he would then use it. It was in this state of mind, prompted by a close relative who was already a permanent inmate of the ashram, that he inducted himself to Sri Bhagavan's presence. He had seen Sri Bhagavan many a time as a boy, when Sri Bhagavan was on the hill abodes. But then, prompted by simple curiosity or youngster desire for the sugar candy or plantains freely distributed in his presence, yet question a relative of his, such as whether Sri Bhagavan would read into his mind and see into his past, present and future, and so on. His relative bade him go to the Swami and ask him all these. Then, in TPR's own words, I entered Sri Bhagavan's hall in this frame of mind and looked at him. That is all. Sri Bhagavan very graciously looked at me in all expectancy, as it were, and full of benign compassion. Yes, he looked into the very core of my being. He was sensing my entire being. I fell flat in prostration to him with an experience as totally consuming as it was convincing. A discovery that he, whom I was hankering for all these years, who could sway my entire being and guide me and my energy, was here. So great, yet so simple was this. I rose up and Sri Bhagavan smiled again and bade me be seated. All the emotions, thoughts, surging doubts were nowhere. I felt I had found my refuge, which was the greatest fortune of my life. It was a conviction born of instant experience by His grace. The present ashram, almost from its inception, had grown and developed to His knowledge, and He had been actively associated with every branch of its growth, while maintaining close contact with Sri Bhagavan and depending on Him for guidance. Few have had this privilege of moving with Sri Bhagavan for so many years, with the ease and freedom of a devoted son to an affectionate parent. This gave him ample opportunities of receiving instruction and guidance, directly or indirectly, from Sri Bhagavan. In later years, it also led to his being helpful in interpreting Sri Bhagavan's utterances to some of the Western devotees and those who did not know Tamil. He has a precious collection of books, including all of Sri Bhagavan's writings from their earliest stages in manuscript form to their revised printed editions. Most of them bear Sri Bhagavan's touch or contain some entries in his own hand, by way of addition, alteration, and correction. TPR was also instrumental in seeing through the press a few editions of Sri Bhagavan's early works, particularly the third edition of Sri Ramana Nur Tirthu, the collected works of Sri Maharshi in Tamil. It was during the period of 1935 to 1945 that TPR had the best of his life at the ashram, constantly benefiting from Sri Bhagavan's uplifting influence. Indeed, he felt by then that there could be nothing more important or useful for his future than to serve Sri Bhagavan till the end. When Sri Bhagavan's fatal physical affliction appeared for the first time, ending in an operation and then recurred, TPR made up his mind and wound up his practice and interest in Madras. Thereafter, he was fortunate enough to join the small band of attendants who looked after Sri Bhagavan's personal comforts and needs. During the whole 2 years the illness lasted, he stayed permanently with him, and the opportunities of service he had are treasured by him. He helpfully assisted the doctors and attendants during the anxious months preceding the 14th April 1950 by his instructive guidance and meticulous attention to prescribed routines. When asked to put in clear terms what he meant by the impact of Sri Bhagavan's grace on him, TPR said, "I'm not left with any sense of want or void and internal strength. This is the direct result of a conviction instilled by experience by the grace of Sri Bhagavan, and it should be so with everyone who has sought his grace." Like other old devotees of Sri Bhagavan, T.P. R. shuns publicity, but anyone coming in contact with him will immediately perceive how great his devotion to Sri Bhagavan is and how deep his understanding of his teaching. It is our good fortune that he resides here, making himself available to all those who want to have a glimpse of what Sri Bhagavan is and what the word grace can really mean. Letters to the editor. This is the letter. To some of your ignorant readers, your insistence on the inevitability of a guru seems to need explaining. May we ask for enlightenment? When a sadhu looks into the eyes of his guru, what he sees or does not see is what is looking, which is the guru within. When he hears his guru's voice, what he hears or does not hear is what is listening, which is the guru within. This is way will we. Okay. The question. But he gives an answer here. When his guru touches him, what he feels or does not feel is what is sensorially experiencing, which is the guru within. When his guru speaks, what he cognizes or does not cognize is what is cognizing, which is the guru within. Is not this why there is no seer, hearer, toucher, cognizer, no thing seen, heard, felt, cognized, but I manifesting, which is the guru within? But where is the guru? I find all this when I look into the eyes of my cat. I would surely find it if I looked into your eyes or those of the Maharshi. One of the greatest sages in China, Shen Hu, seventh patriarch of Chen, said, "In seeing does not need a teacher. Based on such in seeing, a living being can attain Buddhahood." Wherein lies the discrepancy? Where were we? Editor. As the Maharshi often said, and as I explained in the last paragraph of my editorial of July 1964, the guru is the self in the heart, and it is possible for one who is sufficiently pure and concentrated to contact this inner guru directly without the help of an outer guru. In most cases, however, the influence of an outer guru is necessary to lead one back to the guru in the heart. Even Wei Wu-Wei, if he had had the opportunity of looking into the eyes of the Maharshi, might have found it different from looking into the eyes of a cat. Couldn't let him get away with that. I'll just read one more. I should like to congratulate your excellent journal, wishing it to go from success to success with each issue. Scaling new peaks of achievement. There is absolutely no ego on its pages. Okay. But theoretically, it is deceptively simple to pose the question, who am I? Mount Everest looks very near, but to climb it is so difficult. Bhagavan has flown over its top in an aeroplane, which does not fall to everyone's lot. Many people are carried away by academic discussion or his philosophy without any progress whatsoever in their daily lives. Armchair theorists with no elbow grease propound their theories, which cannot bring the truth an inch nearer to the hearts of their readers. I would therefore suggest 1. To open a column for questions on strictly practical aspects of Bhagavan's teaching with editorial replies. 2. To invite articles for novices steeped in the ignorance of the material world. Three. I mean, he said before that, he said the discussion that gives you no, takes you nowhere. Three. To publish articles concerned with practical suggestions for sadhana, with individual experiences of various types. In fact, I feel that less theory and more practice is what is needed. Sanat Taylor Alwar. Alwar.
Alwar, okay.
From Bombay. Editor. I try to the best of my ability to combine theory and practice. In fact, some of our more intellectual readers were not too pleased with the April issue because it leaned too far to the side of practice. Both are needed. In the letters to the editor, section anyone is at liberty to ask practical as well as theoretical questions. So no new section is needed. Okay. Cut them off.
Saturday, remember that Sahasrara Puja.